Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Matson, your host and the editor of Self-Build Magazine.
Today, I am joined by Dr. Ciara Hearn, who's an engineer and a senior lecturer at TU Dublin. She's been crunching numbers for the Irish Building Stock Observatory to gain a better understanding of the energy performance of the building sector. So Ciara is here today to chat about what the best options are for people who want to upgrade the energy efficiency of their home and what changes are coming from Europe in the form of the recast Energy Performance of Building Directive, a real mouthful. Anyway, so Ciara, thanks really for joining us. And we'll start off with the energy upgrade side of thing. So can you give us an overview of what the difference is between a shallow versus a deep retrofit? We hear these words bandied about, but just to give a bit of clarity on that.
Yeah, sure. To my mind, the difference between a shallow and deep retrofit is a deep retrofit should allow the retrofit of a heat pump and the house conditions or the dwelling conditions should enable that heat pump running at a reasonable cost. So a shallow measure, it maybe is a measure that might make a deeper measure more difficult or expensive. So a shallow measure would lock in, you know, locks in a suboptimal retrofit maybe. And so a heat pump needs an airtight dwelling, it needs high levels of efficiency of the fabric, and it needs a low surface temperature system. So all that needs to work together for the heat pump to run at a reasonable cost.
Okay, so then, yeah, so then our shallow stuff would be what we would have all done to put a bit of insulation in the attic maybe and something like that. That wouldn't be enough to make the house good enough for a heat pump then. So how good does a house need to be for a heat pump? There is a measure, isn't there? Like there is, you need to reach a certain, like how much insulation do you need to put into a house for that to happen? How airtight and how insulated? You have to go and spend the 60 grand or whatever those figures are in terms of that.
It depends on your house size, I suppose, because you're dealing with the meter squared of the house and insulation fitted to that meter squared of the house. The smaller the house, the easier it is kind of to achieve on a cost. But you do need, you know, significant levels of insulation. So the roof wouldn't be enough. 89% of roofs typically in Ireland are already quite well insulated because it's kind of an easy measure to do because your attics are accessible. Walls, you know, we've pumped a lot of our cavity walls. Like if you have cavity walls, you can pump them. Otherwise, you're looking at dry lining or external wall insulation. The floors, ideally, because if you were with a heat pump, you'd look at underfloor heating and you don't want to lose any of the heat from through the floors. You want to put it into the space. And airtight measures, you can do a lot by just closing up a lot of the holes that come out of your building, you know, from waste pipes. If you have old floorboards, you can use a rubber and put them in between the floorboards. The air tightness is probably one of the low cost, high impact measures you can do, but you basically go as far as you can go and you can afford to go because all of that means the heat pump runs at lower temperatures, which means it runs at a lower cost.
So then it's always a good idea to go for deep retrofit if you can afford it, is it? Or
100%. Because, you know, if we're looking, and I know we're going to talk about the energy performance recast in a while, but from 2030, the energy performance directive is not now going to be on how much energy you use. It's going to be on how much emissions you emit, how much carbon dioxide your dwelling emits. So if you have a heat pump, you're going to benefit from the greening of the grid. And if you have a heat pump, maybe in tandem with PV, as the grid improves, your energy rating is going to improve. But if you have a fossil fuel boiler, as the rating scheme develops, you're going to just slide down that scale continually because the tail of the scale is going to get longer. Heat pumps are going to be better and fossil fuels are going to be punished under the new regime.
Okay, so does it like if you're going to be insulating your house to the hilt and making it really airtight and have a good ventilation system in there, do you, the heat pump would be mostly for hot water then, or like would you need that much heating in the first place? Do you need to invest in such a high end? I've always had trouble with this idea of heat pumps and because they're very expensive to install as well.
They are. But say, now I have, my house is a 200 meter square dwelling, but I have a heat pump that is only 6 kilowatts. That's in, it's a small heat pump. And actually the running load for the house is actually only 4 kilowatts. The trick with a heat pump is to size them really, really tight to the load and then use a secondary heat source when it's very, very cold outside, like -3, -4°C. And then you can heat your water at nighttime using a nighttime electricity tariff. And you, if you have underfloor heating, you heat that at nighttime as well. And that makes them very cost effective to run. But their efficiencies are, you know, three, four times that of the most efficient boiler. And they're only going to get more efficient with time as the electricity grid gets more green. Your primary energy consumption, which your BER is rated against, is coming down as the grid, as more renewables get integrated into the grid.
So, and hopefully with time as well, the heat pumps will become more affordable. And the smaller the heat pump, I guess, the cheaper it is. How much would that set you back? How much, do you remember how much you paid for yours? If that's a question I can ask.
Yeah, I got mine under the SEI deep retrofit scheme. You know, the grants are very good for heat pumps and you know, they're constant, you know, they're a key part of decarbonizing the building sector. So the grants are quite generous.
Yeah.
What sometimes happens is there's a tendency to oversize them and you're putting too big a unit in and it's not running at its most efficient speed because it's too big. It's running at too low a speed for its compressor. So a small heat pump sized correctly with a grant over the lifetime of the project, when you look at your electricity bills, you know, my electricity bill for the last 2 months is only €149. Because you're using the heat pump correctly. So you're already saving money from the time that it's in.
Okay. So how was that grant process? Was it fairly straightforward? I suppose you being an engineer, it would have been easy for you enough to go through that whole the jumping through all those hoops, but how?
Yes. Well, I had a sort of equivalent of a one-stop shop, only the one-stop shops are coming out now, but I got my deep retrofit through Kingspan, and they managed the whole process for me. So it was really quite seamless.
Okay. And how, in terms of the grant and paying out, did you have to pay it out first and then they paid you back, or was it, were the costs covered?
In three installments. So I had to pay half, some up front, some at the interim, and then some at the end. So it was manageable. Like, it was costly, but it was half what it would have cost me otherwise.
Yeah. So you got about half of the cost covered by them. And how much was it, if you're okay with sharing that?
Well, it was 100 grand and I paid 50.
Okay. Yeah. So it is, it's a chunk of change. Like, yeah. So then always go for deep retrofit is the advice. There's never really a case to go shallow then, is there not?
There's not really. In a way, you're better off not going at all with shallow. In terms of the fabric, I would say in that case, you'd be better to invest in increasing the efficiency of your heating system. You're heating 70% of the costs of running a household in Ireland are on the heating system. And with very kind of low cost measures, you can save 20% in that heating system overnight by installing TRVs. Looking at your heating pump. Your heating pump, believe it or not, is the fourth largest energy consuming product in the world, because it's always trundling away there in the background when you have your heating system on. Using a good control system, that would save energy 20% overnight. And you're not investing heavily in the fabric, and you're not locking in a suboptimal retrofit. People who don't do deep retrofit tend to be older people. That just maybe don't see the value in their lifetime of doing the work. But if on sale of that house, on changeover of that house, probably deeper work would be done in any case. The shallow retrofit can just inhibit deeper work going forward.
Okay. And in terms of doing it right, I suppose that's the big thing, isn't it? I mean, there is this whole thing of skilling up the workforce and all that. How can you check that the work's done correctly? Because if you have a gap in insulation, if the boards aren't really tight, or you could lead to condensation and things like that. So how can someone who has no knowledge really check for that? You can't really, can you? You have to rely on your one-stop shop provider.
Yeah, a lot of the time, but KSN Energy, or I'm not sure it's KSN Energy, but KSN, the company, they at the moment have the contract for SEI, and they inspect. If a homeowner takes photographs of the work as it goes and progresses, there's a helpline. You can always check everything. You can sanity check it with others. Good communication with your builder, asking questions. But anything that's grant aided is inspected. And if it's not done to standard, the works are redone before the grant is awarded. So there's a huge amount of protection through the one-stop shop mechanism. So if you're not confident of going it yourself, I'd certainly go through that one-stop shop route. Okay.
So take photos is the thing when you're going through it as well, then, to make
sure. And then you have the documentary evidence for your BER. And you've shown the upgrades, and there's no ambiguity when it comes to certifying the property at the end of the day.
Yeah. So I looked a bit at your research, and it looked like one of your papers were saying that rural one-off houses would probably benefit the most from deep retrofits. I don't know if I read that correctly or not, but you did an analysis of rural housing versus... what's the profile of, like, would there be a bigger benefit for them, or what was the paper?
Well, I sort of always, when I look at research, I kind of, well, what's going to make the most difference to the climate change first? What's the heaviest hitter? And in Ireland, our predominant house type is rural dwellings. 40% of our dwellings are rural detached dwellings. And the majority of those are single, your bungalow that we're all familiar with on the Irish landscape. So I focused on those as our predominant house type, but they also have the worst heat loss characteristic, in that they have the largest surface area to volume ratio. So they have the most opportunity for heat loss through the fabric. And so I looked at those dwellings, because if you could retrofit those dwellings to fit a heat pump, you could fit a heat pump in any other dwelling, because if you solved the hardest one to solve first and prove that it worked, which I did, and that was back in 2010, you could show that a heat pump can be viably retrofitted into any other dwelling type.
But at what cost? Again, if for your own house it was, what'd you say, 200 square meters, which is fairly big, I suppose, it was $100,000 and then 50% grant aided. How much, I mean, for a detached house, that'd be like a 4-bedroom.
It would, the cost would probably be less than that, slightly less than that, but I don't think much more. But EPCs, like under the new EPC scheme, all dwellings, they're looking to harmonise the bottom G dwellings, the bottom 15%, but they're also looking to bring the furthest behind first. So maybe bring a G up to a D. If you are looking at a dwelling that is as built and you're going to live in it for your life, the banks are looking at your ability and they're factoring that in. When they're lending you money, your ability to repay, factoring in that cost under the expectation that under the regulations, you're going to have to bring that house up to a higher energy rating in any case. So I think you're always looking at it. You know, if you're looking at an old house, you know, for modern standards of comfort and also to future-proof the dwelling, to enable it for a heat pump, you're looking to do it in the most cost-effective way, but you do have to upgrade the fabric, reduce the air tightness, and ideally put in a heat pump, and ideally with PV, you know, towards the electrified economy. That's the only way you're going to have an A-rated house that's going to stay an A-rated house going forward.
So, I know I'm probably too skeptical about the whole thing, but like, is it really worth like the savings if you're going to spend that much money to upgrade, let's say, your detached house, over even, I know you were saying like elderly people might not see the return, but even for anyone, you know, how much are you really saving in electricity use? Now the carbon thing is different. Obviously, we all want to help the climate, and from that point of view, it makes sense. But the economic argument isn't necessarily there, is it? Really? I mean,
yeah. Well, the carbon case is four times that the economical case. But
yeah,
you know, I suppose being an engineer, I never considered any other route than making it the highest energy rating that you could in favor of reduced energy bills. Like, I suppose I'm in my 40s, moving into the house. I have three kids. My plan is to live in this house for life. And so I considered it worth it. It wouldn't have been able to afford the same level without the grant. Probably would have had, like, I wouldn't maybe have PV on the roof without the grant. Wouldn't have been able to afford that. But I certainly would have put the infrastructure in first, so that in time, you know, as, you know, my kids become maybe less costly, you could then invest in it. You know, there's nothing, you know, we have the app and looking at the solar, like 30% of our electricity use now is provided through the PV, and it's fantastic. And it's, again, for 2 months, there's six people living in this house at the moment, our electricity bill was €149 over a cold period of the year. And that was on a red meter, you know, wasn't an estimated amount. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're looking at a poorly insulated dwelling, the cost of gas and oil is only going up. It's becoming less certain with geopolitical upsets such as Ukraine. There's no certainty there, where, you know, the government is working to bring the cost of electricity down. You're reducing your impact on the environment. And, you know, I took a 1901 house and turned it into an A2 dwelling. And that legacy will outlast me, you know, for generations.
Yeah.
Because 40% of greenhouse gas emissions come from the sector, and 3/4 of that come from houses. So the lion's share of emissions, accounting for over 28%, comes from households. So it's a major area that we need to consider to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I accept your argument on cost. My thing is, if there's any way you can afford it, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, from that point of view. But you presented some figures as well of the showing that, let's say, G-rated house, the more inefficient houses don't necessarily consume a whole lot more energy than, let's say, a B or a C-rated house, in the sense that, like, I know I live in a really old house, single glazing, I can't change the windows kind of house, and I obviously don't put the heat on nonstop, and the house isn't roasting, that's for sure, but I my energy bills is something I can afford because I just don't turn the heating on as much. So in actual fact, does upgrading the energy efficiency really reduce your use? You know, weren't those figures what were showing that a G-rated home kind of consumes the same rate as what a B or C kind of on average?
Sometimes, the difference between actual and rated energy use. In actual fact, it doesn't tend to, no, because G-rated dwellings tend to be older dwellings. That actually have quite a small floor area. So if you have a 10 kilowatt load and you divide that by a small floor area, you get a higher rating, if you know what I mean, per kilowatt hour of meter squared, it's high. And sometimes with a bigger A-rated dwelling, a more modern typically dwelling, the larger, through the Tiger economy, we grew our floor area quite exponentially. We have like the fourth largest floor area in Europe. You know, we like our big houses, but you could have an A-rated dwelling that is it still uses 10 kilowatts, same as your G-rated, but it's divided by a much larger floor area. So it does much better on the EPC scale or the BER scale than your G-rated dwelling, but you can actually use the same amount of energy. And it's to do with looking at it and dividing it by floor area and typically that discrepancy in floor area.
Yeah. So, but at the end of the day, really, if you're looking at what we're consuming for energy wise, as opposed to what it says on paper on the energy rating, it's the same, really.
It's the
Isn't
same.
That what matters is
it
how
is.
Much...
It is. And that's why the recast of the Energy Performance Directive is looking now at emissions. So your 10 kilowatt emissions will be the same in your G rated as your 10 kilowatt emissions in your A rated dwelling. So that's the scale. That's what's going to change. They're going to focus on emissions and not energy. I don't know whether it's going to be per meter squared or per dwelling. Per dwelling is a better metric than per meter squared because the meter squared skews the data to make, you know, to make that discrepancy you highlighted, you know, and create that energy performance gap.
Yeah. So is that the main headline change of the
EPBD? It's one of them. The other is that the current scheme is going to stay in place on rated on energy till 2030. But after that, it's going to be a ZEB building, a zero emission building will be an A-rated building, and a building that maybe has PV in the roof and can contribute to the grid will be an emission positive building. So that will be an A-plus building. Now, this is only proposed at the minute. This is in the outline document. There's no, you know, that it'll be up to each member state how they actually formulate the EPC scheme in each country. Like at the moment, we've 31 different schemes across Europe and the EU, because while the Energy Performance of Building Directive prescribe it, it's up to the member states as how they implement it.
Weren't they going to harmonize that though?
They're going to harmonize the scale. So.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe they might seek to harmonize the methodology, but they're going to harmonize the scale. So what they've said is the bottom 15% across Europe will all be a 15. And then this is this idea of a just transition in bringing the furthest behind, reaching the furthest behind first, that all G-rated dwellings was going to be mooted, that they go to an F. But there's a new proposal now that they'd all go for a D, and that's being negotiated at the moment. And I think it depends on Spain or coming in on the presidency, what their view is on it. So not yet defined, but it's looking more likely that it'll be bringing everything up 3 points from a G to a D.
Okay. Mm. And so would that mean then someone who's built an A-rated house, let's say in the past couple of years, their house could become a B after this comes into force?
Yes. Yeah. And it's, if you have a fossil fuel boiler, it's likely that it will go down
even more.
But if you have a heat pump and PV, it's likely that it'll start to come up over time. So the EPC changes over time, and it used to last for 10 years. But I think it's above a C, it lasts for 10 years, but anything below a C or will last for 10 years, but anything below that will only last for 5 years before you have to get another energy rating.
But that's only if you sell your house. Do you need to?
Yes. Yes. But it has a legacy. If it's bought, sold or leased, it's a lifetime. It's only valid.
Right.
So, yeah. So if you buy or sell something within that time frame, you don't need to get a new one. But if you do, then you would have to get a new one. It's a 5-year time frame for poorly performing and a 10-year for highly performing.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And on the topic of solar panels, then the draft of this recast EPBD then is looking at kind of basically putting panels on most houses, isn't it? Anyway, definitely new builds.
Yes, definitely new builds by 2028. And the language in the document is where technically suitable and economically feasible. So
it's a bit of a cop out.
No, it's not. Solar panels work when they're 30 degrees east and west of south, really. So if you have a roof that's 30 degrees east or west of south, you should be looking to put PV. If it's due east or due west or due north, it's not as economically feasible or viable. You know, if the more east and west they go, the angle of the panel needs to go horizontal. And say in an old roof, that's not suitable because it could end up taking your roof. But if you had a flat roof on an extension, you could put east-facing panels or west-facing panels in a horizontal orientation.
Mm. But the thing is, if you're building new, generally speaking, you can decide which way your roof is going to face.
Yes. And
you could design that in. It could be a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really, you know, it's going forward, it's very, very cost effective. Like I have a neighbor of mine, and she loves her bath and her tumble dryer, and she's able to heat her water and use her tumble dryer. She has an app that's showing when the sun is shining, and she's still emission neutral. You know, so you change your behavior in the household to match when the sun is shining and when your system is generating. And she's no regrets of that system. And she spent considerably more in her system than I would have on mine. I could only fit 7 panels. And I think she has something like 12 panels on her roof. So right. It depends, you know. I use mine with a battery. So I charge the battery overnight on the cheap electricity tariff. And I discharge it in the morning, and then it charges in the day. And then I get that to discharge between 5 and 7 in the evening under those peak loads. because, you know, in time, the ESB or whomever your provider is, they're going to give you a higher tariff between 7 and 9 in the morning and 5 and 7 in the afternoon when the grid is under pressure.
Okay. So, but the thing with PV panels as well is, would it make, like, isn't there something about in this recast to try to make it more of a community thing where you'd have, let's say, like, you know, if you have your 9 and your neighbor is 12, wouldn't it make sense to have like maybe 30 and share it, you know, just to share the infrastructure? Wouldn't that be cheaper and a more efficient way of using it, even in terms of all the bits that go into batteries and not the best environmentally friendly materials?
Yes, you can use the grid, but you see that the issue with PV, that embodied carbon does come into it. So that's being considered in the global warming potential of your infrastructure. So it depends, like if you look at solar panels, you might have to consider where you buy them from. A lot of them come from China. China's a coal-fired predominantly grid, so they're quite energy intensive to manufacture in China. But if you bought your panel from Norway, who are predominantly hydro-powered electricity, the cost of developing them, the embodied carbon cost of developing them in Norway is less than that of China. So choosing where you buy your product from would impact embodied carbon, but that might be, in time, there's a move towards considering all of that in the, you know, the rating of the product that you buy. But with PV, the highest generation is at 12 o'clock in the day. And unless you're serendipitously using electricity at 12 o'clock in the day, you're not really reaping the advantage of having the PV panel on your roof. You have to store it for later use. So really, they work very well with batteries, and they're not as cost effective, I would argue, without them. Mm-hmm. But if you know, again, all that embodied carbon that comes with the manufacture and the harvesting, you know, that has to be regularized, like anything, I suppose, in as things are developing. But the micro generation you spoke of, that one house positively contributing, again, that's caught in, your house would be an A+, and the government now are giving you money for the power you export. I think it's 21 cent per kilowatt hour. So you then end up with,
good, yeah.
It's pretty good, you know, yeah. And you end up with a credit on your bill. So the neighbor I spoke about, she's not paying any electricity because she's contributing so much into the grid. So she's in credit, I think, about to €250 with her provider at the moment.
Yeah. That's pretty nice. Better get some panels up. So for the EPBD, then the draft, the renovation side of things, how is that going to impact people who have an existing house? I mean, there's a lot, obviously for new builds, it's easier because you're starting from scratch, but will there be obligations on people? Because there's talk of having to upgrade all this building stock, but you know, if people can't afford it, then sure, it's not going to happen unless the government steps in, obviously, and pays for it. But
well, the government do step in and pay for it for anybody that's on any grant scheme like fuel allowance, you know, and they get 100% grant aided for any retrofits. The sort of higher end of the socioeconomic scale, you could argue that people maybe can afford it. They tend to have bigger houses, though, so the cost is greater. In a sense, it's the middle that, you know, the young families with kids that, you know, that are both time and cash poor, they are the most affected by it. But certainly if you have a G-rated dwelling, they're going to have to come up with schemes to support people. And the directive is very strong on this kind of green finance, and that financing is a critical part of this transition. And it sets out a framework for how renovation should be handled, and protections should be in place for tenants in rental housing to avoid rent evictions. There's a huge focus on language of just transition, that it's happening in a fair way, leaving no one behind, and again, reaching the furthest behind first. I think research has to be done as to how that's achieved. I know in some countries they have 100% grant schemes for everybody.
Right.
Maybe okay. The government might have to consider that. You know, a lot of that work is something that we're doing. The Irish Building Stock Observatory is looking at the state of the stock, where the stock is located. We're getting to a point by using machine learning and AI of being able to look at the state of the stock quarterly to observe what type of dwellings and what type of, you know, of socioeconomic brackets are reacting to the renovation wave, like which ones are moving, which ones are moving rapidly, which ones are moving slowly, which ones are moving not at all, they're resisting the renovation wave. And by looking at those, we'll be able to maybe get under the bonnet of those to say, well, why are they hard to decarbonize? What are their characteristics? What specific policy measures are needed to be put in place to get these dwellings to react to the renovation wave or move? It's kind of the idea came from COVID, in that we have nuanced policy that's reacting to data in a live way. You know, NEFIT, we're reflecting the data, and government, we're making policy in an agile manner to react to the data. So we would see the climate emergency as being, you know, really as urgent. And so that looking at the data and keeping an eye and observing the data and commenting on the data will allow politicians and policymakers to create nuanced policies to directly target, to ensure that just transition, to find out who's been left behind and why, and how we help, how society and government policy helps that move. Transition.
When is the directive going to come into force? Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, it's an EU legislative framework, and then it needs to be adopted into law by each member state. So it's due for publication in Q3, Q4 this year. And on average, it takes maybe 18 months to adopt it into Irish law. And then we will require an update to our building regulations and the BR methodology. So maybe 12 months after that.
So right, okay.
It could be like late 2026 or sometime in 2026, which doesn't give you a lot of time between that and 2028 when you have to have solar technologies on all new builds.
Yeah. And on major renovations, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, by 2032 for solar.
2032, yeah. Yeah. But so just the, I suppose the last thing that we, the last topic, I guess, was the heating systems one. So just in terms of optimizing your heating system in the home, what can people do? Like, let's say if it's not necessarily an option to start investing in an energy upgrade, and they're on that data point where they're resisting the renovation wave, what can they do to at least lower their bills? Are there steps that are fairly straightforward?
Very straightforward. And I always think this is the low hanging fruit. And there's a huge amount of emphasis on fabric, on PV, on these really, you know, high cost measures. And, you know, I've often, you know, I titled a paper, it didn't get through, but I was saying the heating system, the forgotten system. You know, we have 70% of our bills, the lion's share of our bills is from our heating system. We use our heating system in Ireland to heat our space through radiators and heat our water through our calorifier or our hot water tank. So 70% of energy is on the heating system, 40 to 50% of that is on space heating, and 20 to 30% of that is on heating the hot water. So if the, again, I spoke about the circulation pump, you know, that's running all the way in the background, and it's the fourth largest energy consuming product in the world. And it actually accounts for 5 to 10% of your ESB bill or your electrical bill. But that's forgotten about. But these pumps, there was an EU Optimus project looking at the heating system. The pumps are typically 3 times bigger than what's required. Your boiler is 1.8 times the size it's required, and your radiators are typically 1.7 times the size it's required. So your heating system is handling a lot more water than it requires, you know, to meet the load. So that costs in that you're heating a bigger volume of water up that's unnecessary, and you're pumping a bigger volume of water than necessary around the system. So it's called hydraulic balancing, and any plumber is able to do this. And it used to be standard practice years ago, but I think, you know, in the Tiger economy, when we're building so many houses, the practice was a bit lost, you know, in favor of time. But you can just throttle down through the Lockshield valve, which is on every radiator in your house, reduce the flow rate through your radiator so that it's balanced. That reduces the flow rate in your pump, and it reduces the amount of water that your boiler has to cope with. And by just doing that, you can save 20% of energy on your bill, on your heating bill, which is 14% of your bill overall, typically.
That's really interesting, because, you know, there's a lot of talk, especially with heat pumps, I suppose, but it would apply to any heating system, I guess, is this undersizing. We are afraid to undersize, because if it undersizes, then it has to work too hard and then you're kind of burning out the system a bit too quickly, and it's not efficient either. So I guess oversizing is just as bad, then, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I would argue that oversizing is worse than undersizing, because you could always add a secondary heat source in extreme weather conditions. And again, that's the way you should run your heat pump, because it's a machine that has a compressor in it. It likes to run at the same revs per minute. It doesn't like stop, start. You know, there's a startup energy in starting and stopping that compressor. It's better to run that consistently at the same speed than on, off, on, off, on, off, which is what it would do if it's oversized, because it's meeting the load very quickly and then it switches itself off again. And then it starts up again when the load drops. So it's, you know, it's just not the way to run them if you can help it. And even just on optimizing, you know, across Europe, everyone uses a heating system. So if everyone optimized their heating system in Europe, you'd save the same amount of energy that Ireland uses in a year.
Right.
Because it's such a ubiquitous system and it's such a large energy, you know, 70% of your heat, of your energy bill is on it. So any saving, it's the lion's share of the energy use. So any saving there is more impactful.
So then in terms of the installations, then is there a way to make sure everything's done correctly and to the right sizing? What can we do about that?
You have to do the heat loss calculation from first principles, really, you know, looking at the house. Every house is kind of like a fingerprint in a way, you know, it's all facing a different orientation or this or that or different characteristics. So you size it tight to the load with a secondary heat source when weather conditions are extreme. I heat my water only to 45 degrees C. I don't heat it to 60 degrees C. Heat pumps don't like lifting high temperatures. I heat it to 60 degrees once a week to scald it, to kill Legionnaires. So Legionnaires is why you would keep the avoidance of Legionella growth would be why you would set a tank to 60 degrees. But that's a historical thing now. It's shown that it grows at a show rate. And so scalding it once a week to 60 is enough. And it makes no sense to heat something to 60 and then be thermostatically cooling it down to use it for a shower. Like, we shower at 30, 35 degrees. So 45 degrees is plenty, if you understand, you know. We shower all the time in this house. There's six people living here and 45 degree tank. Nobody has ever complained about it. And then, you know, the use, if you're using electricity, the integration of PV, you know, so sometimes if you have excess PV, you can use that to heat the water in your tank. But you heat that at night. So really, you know, to answer your question, what needs to be done industry-wide, I think we need innovation in the heating sector is really rapid. There's no such thing as a simple system anymore. And there's no such thing as a simple house anymore. It's very complex, you know, to meet all these requirements of the Energy Performance of Building Directive. And the plumber is the expert. The plumbing craftsman is the expert in the residential sector. But in Ireland, we have no unified body that unifies plumbers. You have the RGAI for gas and you have Ofttech for oil, but you have no one institution that brings plumbers back and where they have to do continual professional development like engineers or architects. And I really think we need that for the sector, because if you look at plumbing craftsmen, they might leave their apprenticeship, you know, quite young in their early 20s. And now they're talking about we're pushing the retirement age out to 70. So the amount of innovations that happen in that time, it's very important to keep the plumbing craftsman upskilled in all these innovations. And I think really that's a key factor for the, certainly for the residential sector. The commercial sector tends to be taken care of by building services engineers paid as part of the design team. But again, you know, the one-stop shops could be a mechanism where that design standards, design calculations occur with the specification being given over then for the construction.
Yeah. But is there, are there efforts to create a body like that to for
not
the plumbers?
To my knowledge.
You know, that EU Optimus project, I think I did that in 2013 or 2014, and I was responsible for English speaking countries across Europe, so UK and Malta and Ireland. And I wasn't able to roll out the learnings from the project through a CPD program because there was no body that facilitated that, but it was in other European countries at the time. And you could see, like in Hungary, they were just rolling it out immediately. What was developed in the research was rolled out through the CPD, and in Ireland it wasn't possible. So
how about the NSAI? Could they
Develop the standards? They develop the standards, but the standards get published, and then it's up to the individual to read and apply the standard.
They also have a register of, let's say, the airtightness installers, and they hold, don't they have?
They have
the airtightness installers. I'm not aware for plumbing, for the heating system.
Yeah,
it seems when it accounts for 70% of your load and the lion's share, like heat, is the elephant in the room when you're talking about energy.
Yeah.
And it's really a huge sector and really needs a specific focus.
Especially with all the upgrades that are happening now, for sure. Okay, dokes. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
Join us next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Self-Build Plus. It'll give you full access to the selfbuild.ie website, including the Self-Build Plus journey, which is your step-by-step guide to self-building and home improving. Your membership also gives you first access to all videos and podcasts, as well as access to our members-only Facebook group, which features regular Facebook Live events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.